This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. More than a decade after it opened in a former church, the Scottsboro Boys Museum and Cultural Center in Alabama will be renovated this month. The museum remembers nine black teenagers, four of them from Chattanooga, who were falsely accused of raping two white women while traveling through Jackson County, Alabama, by train in 1931. The defendants were held in Scottsboro during a series of three trials. Eight of the nine youths were wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death by all-white, all-male juries. Twice, the United States Supreme Court heard arguments in the case, leading to landmark civil rights rulings on the right to counsel and non-discrimination in juror roles. Sheila Washington is the museum's founder, director, and tour guide. Sheila, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here today.
Tell us more about where things stand with the museum and cultural center at this time.
Well, the museum is going on a major renovation. The building is 150 years old, so we started renovating and to bring new bath restrooms in to make it handicap accessible. And this project that's now to bring it up to a modern technology tech museum like Rosa Parks, Civil Rights Museum, started in 2017, but we didn't have the funding to start then. And all of a sudden it kicked back up and we still had the design that we paid for. I decided to go for it. It was a $100,000 project. And so we didn't have any money. And we met with our local legislative office, some of the people in the community, and our board went to local Senator Steve Livingston, who listened to us. And we also went before the city council, who we've been here 10 years. This is our 10th year celebration. So that's why I wanted to do something to enhance the museum. We went before the city council first time in 10 years. They gave us $20,000 that they ever given us anything. So the $20,000 was a jump start towards the renovation project. Our senator told us that he was going to work on getting this money. So we set up a GoFundMe account on our website. We upgraded our website and got it up and going with the help of the Chamber of Commerce. So we have a GoFundMe account on it. And at this point in time, we are almost there with every bit of money, almost $100,000. So we're hoping to start the renovation project in January and have it done in February, which opened the museum up February the 1st in 2010. And so what better time to have a new grand opening of the museum in February of 2021, showing the new museum off and what we have done to make it a more enhanced, accessible museum that it will talk to you. And I won't do as many presentations anymore in the museum. People will walk around and look and see, and it's going to be ghostly figures of the boys in the museum. And we have the actual bench that they sit on while they were locked up in county jail here. And we're going to have a jailhouse scenery, a courthouse scenery, a Jim Crow era, and it's going to tell history.
And it's even more important than ever to tell that history. In 2031, it will be 100 years since the events took place.
And what surprises me, this case never gets old. We still have people to come and travel from around the world to this little old church building to see what we have in there, things that they hadn't seen, just walking into a place that honored the Scottsboro Boys. It just renovates, it does something to their spirit. Everybody said they can feel their presence there. And when I opened up that museum and got the key to the old church, I said to those nine young men, I said, now you have a place to call home and you can rest and your story can be told. Because it was bouncing here, there, and everywhere. It was nowhere that they could say, this is the Scottsboro Boys Museum to honor those nine young black men.
So many facets to this story, from the train ride to the stop to the multiple trials to the multiple times that this case went to the United States Supreme Court. And to be able to have a touchstone, it fills in a gap that has been sorely missing for a long time.
It has. And what's so amazing that this story still has legs, that it has walked over into the 21st century, and we're still finding out things that happened during this case that nobody knew about, that we're able to talk about, or people are giving over things that they held on to, or that family members have held on to for years, to put it somewhere. Like, I had a 96-year-old lady out of Huntsville. She had a bench that was used during the trial, and her daddy was one of the lawyers that helped represent the Scottsboro Boys in Decatur. And she said, I'm getting older, and she said, I'm cleaning out some things. And she said, my father brought this home with him when the trial was over with. And she said, I want it in a good place, and no other place other than the Scottsboro Boys Museum would I like to have this bench put in there. So we have the bench that she gave us 2 years ago in the museum. And if it was used during the trial, that means that bench is over 100 years old. So we are in the 100th year already with things that people have given us.
This case has many connections to right here in Chattanooga.
Definitely. Matter of fact, right there in Tennessee in a graveyard is two of the Scottsboro Boys, the two brothers, Andy and Roy Wright, are buried in a cemetery along beside their mother and their sister that traveled with their mother. Miss Ada Wright didn't even have an education, but that lady traveled around the world. And when women wasn't allowed to participate or lead a parade, she marched down the streets of Switzerland leading a parade, and they snuck her into Moscow, where she spoke before thousands of people talking about the Scottsboro Boys, how she would long to see her sons freed and found not guilty of the charges that they had been charged with. So yes, there is a big connection. Four of them was from Tennessee. My interest has never left me since I was 17 years old. The story that I tell is how I found that little book hidden under my parents' bed, wrapped in plastic in a pillowcase. And every Saturday I would have to vacuum that room and under that bed, and there was that pillowcase, and I didn't know what was in it. So one day I opened it up and saw this little paperback book, Haywood Patterson, Scottsboro Boy. And I said, well, it's just a book. And I read it. And before I got all the way completely through, my father took it away and said he didn't want me to read it. It was too much hurtful, harmful things in it. So at 18 years old, my brother was killed in Kilby Prison in Montgomery, Alabama, the same prison the Scottsboro Boys was housed in at the time. And I knew then that because what he had done, my brother had done in Scottsboro, him and another man had killed an elderly white man in this town. And after reading how mean the guards were to the Scottsboro Boys, I just figured that they took justice in their own hand. And my brother was stabbed to death in Kilby Prison, not one time, but his body was stabbed multiple times.
Have you seen renewed interest from other people in the case, given the events of the past year?
I have seen the interest grow here in Scottsboro a lot. Scottsboro is embracing the museum from when we first opened to now. They have shown interest by one thing in February. Not only are we going to show off the museum, but on the courthouse square on the south side, where the Scottsboro Boys marker is on the courthouse square, is going to be a big mural painted across the road from that about the Scottsboro Boys. It don't say Scottsboro Boys, it says Scottsboro, but it has the picture of the boys on the train getting arrested, and it also has four pictures of Judge Harden, the lawyer, Samuel Leibovich, Ruby Bates, who changed her story and said they wasn't guilty, and the sheriff that got killed because he protected those boys a year later, Sheriff Matt Warren. And it's going to show the past coming into the present, where we had the prayer march in June, and they have a big, colorful mule that's going to be painted. When you walk out that courthouse, you're going to see that on the courthouse way. So to me, yes, that's big.
And where can people go online to find out more and to keep up with the renovation and beyond?
We have a website, www.scottsboromuseum.org. We're going to do a time lapse from the time they start the renovation project to the time they end. But we're not going to show the completion of it yet because we want the people to come and see it. But they're going to be seeing the time lapse of where they're in there working and removing some things and making room for the new stuff to come in.
All right. Sheila, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here in the Tennessee Valley, rare minnows are in trouble. How does that affect our ecosystem and what can be done? Back in the fall, I spoke with Bernie Cujeda, an aquatic conservation biologist at the Tennessee Aquarium's Conservation Institute here in Chattanooga. Bernie, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Tell us more about rare minnow species in our area.
We have three threatened and endangered species of minnows. We've got the extremely endangered Laurel Dace, which is found up on Walden Ridge between Dayton and Spring City. We've got the federally endangered Cahaba Shiner that's found in central Alabama that I've done some work on over the last 3 years. And then we have the federally threatened Blue Shiner, which is in Tennessee, just barely gets in the Conasauga River in southeastern Tennessee. And then that river flows through Georgia and eventually into Alabama. And I've studied that fish and we're going to dive into it a little deeper here in the next couple of years.
All of these species face a common series of threats. Tell us more about those threats.
So the greatest threat to aquatic ecosystems throughout the world, as well as right here in our backyard, is number one, habitat fragmentation. All of the dams that have been built with the reservoirs behind them, all of the channelized streams, and you don't even think about it, but those culverts underneath your driveways and roads, those are barriers to fish movement. Historically, these fish had movement in between populations, gene flow, and they maintained healthy genetics. Now that gene flow is cut off and they become isolated, as their genetics become unhealthy, they tend to become unhealthy. Number two is non-point source pollution. You can't point to it and say, that's the problem. Clean Water Act pretty much fixed point source pollution, nasty stuff coming out of a pipe through industry. Now it's non-point source pollution. The biggest problem is sedimentation, dirt coming from poor agricultural practices, poor construction sites that don't have the silt fences. And then we've got a lot of other pollutants like the transmission fluid and oil that are on parking lots. And when it rains, all of that goes directly in. And we're finding an emerging problem. Plastics turn into microplastics and they're in fresh water. And what do those mean? And then the third problem is climate change. We are really getting really high flow water events, which can damage the habitat fish live in. And then we're getting extreme droughts, which really affect these headwater species, especially the Laurel Dace. And then lastly, invasive species, species that don't belong where they are now found. They've been moved around by humans, and that really negatively affects the Laurel Dace and a little bit the Blue Shiner.
And how severe are these threats in just so short a span of time?
We are in sixth mass extinction crisis worldwide. We are losing species at a greater rate than we have in human history. Aquatic ecosystems, freshwater aquatic ecosystems, are 3 to 5 times more imperiled than marine and terrestrial systems because all humans need fresh water to survive. So it's a resource that's used and unfortunately sometimes abused. There's just a great amount of diversity, some of it really localized in fresh water. But trying to protect these little critters also gives us clean drinking water to swim in and fish in, and clean fish to eat when we catch a bass or a brim out of the Tennessee River. So it's not only important to save these little guys, but it also helps us.
Tell us more about the work that you're involved in to save and preserve these species.
So it all begins with just basic surveys. You go out, you survey sites where they have been found, and you survey sites where maybe you could find them and they haven't been found before. And that gets you information on where they are. And then some of them, like the Laurel Days, we've been doing that since 2015 every year, so we can see trends. And the trends aren't good for the Laurel Days. When I started here at the aquarium in 2012, Laurel Days were in 5 streams. They're now down to 2 streams. The other thing is genetics. You need to run population genetics on the species to know what conservation packets you have in order to be able to manage them. Are the Laurel Days way up by Spring City the same Laurel Days genetically in the southern population closer to Dayton? And the answer is they're not. The third thing we've been working on is reproduction. Can we bring them into the Conservation Institute and actually get them to spawn for potential stocking? And we did that with Laurel Days, and we can, so that's good. But then the hard work is trying to stop the degradation of the habitat. And for Laurel Days, it's vegetable crops, mostly tomato fields, up on Walden Ridge on the plateau. They lay plastics along the rows of vegetable crops, so you have an impervious surface on half of your field. So when it rains 1 inch of rain, 2 inches of rainwater, run down those rows, grab all that bare dirt and the herbicides and pesticides, and they go into these mountain streams that are supposed to be rocky, and now they're becoming filled with dirt. That's a real problem. And then what do we do about that? So we're trying to work with NRCS, let me get this right, which is the Natural Resources Conservation Service, basically a government agency that helps farmers keep soil in their fields. It helps the farmers, it helps the aquatic environment. And we did get a small grant to try to get farmers to plant grass in between those vegetable crop rows to hold the soil in place. And we bought a piece of equipment called a crimper that will knock down that grass so it doesn't compete with the vegetables, but it still maintains and holds the soil and improves the soil health for the farmer. So it's a win-win. And we're working on a larger grant now for the Sequatchie Valley and for all where Laurel Days are found up there on the ridge to try to expand this program to plant pollinator fields to hold in the soil and just come up with more innovative ways to keep the soil on the farmlands and not in the streams. And that's the hard work, building trust with local landowners. We have the advantage at the aquarium because we're not a government agency, but we're working both with the landowners and with the government agencies. We're making small inroads, but people have been doing this for generations the way they do it, and it's just hard to get them to change.
And even when you do get them to change, making that change does not yield instant results. You don't create a Laurel Days boom in a season or two.
And that is correct. It's going to take, even if we stopped most of the sediments coming into these streams, it's going to take several years of high water events to naturally flush those sediments out of there. But the important thing is we've got these two streams. One, there's not a lot of crops in it. It's mostly timber, and we're working with the timber company, and they're being great partners. But the other stronghold, there's a lot of farming there, and we really need to try to get a hold of that, as well as where they've disappeared. In order to propagate and restock fishes, we need habitat that they're going to exist in. Otherwise, it's just a waste of time and money.
Where can people go online for more information to help? And if they come to the aquarium, where might they be able to check out more about all this?
You can go to the Tennessee Aquarium webpage. And if you want to help, there's a donate button there. We actually have some Laurel Days on display in the River Journey building. And so you can actually see these gorgeous fishes. They have bright yellow fins, red lips, golden stripe with black on either side, and bright yellow fins and red bellies. They're gorgeous fish. And the blue shiners we study, they're equally gorgeous. Bright blue sides, yellow fins. The Cahaba shiner is just a boring little straw-colored minnow, but I described it way back in 1989, so I have a special place in my heart for that little critter.
All right. Bernie, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Keep up on the latest from NPR online anytime at our website, wutc.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. We've been featuring virtual shows from the Mountain Spirit Acoustic Series Facebook page every Monday for the past couple of months. All of the shows are a benefit for the Isis Theatre in Asheville, where were it not closed because of the pandemic, these performers would be playing for a live audience. Today we have a set from the Nashville-based duo A Tale of Two, featuring the sultry retro vocals of Stephanie Adlington, described as a mix of Patsy Cline's passion and Sarah Vaughan's sophistication on their website, with Aaron Lassard's resonator guitar and kick drumming. Their bio describes Aaron and Stephanie as a couple of steamy storytellers with a penchant for Southern Gothic tales and bluesy Americana. They'll be playing several songs from their first album, set for release in January this afternoon, from their home in Franklin, Tennessee, in front of a group of friends. This is A Tale of Two.
Hey, y'all. Alrighty, we are good to go. All right.
Welcome, everybody.
We're going to give it just a minute here.
Welcome to Nashville, y'all. Yes. So we have some friends in the house. Make sure that stays out of my way.
We're going to do an original called Old Chicago Lightning.
Die by my time, let the moonshine flow. No, 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 that song, we had a fun night looking up a whole bunch of prohibition terms in slang, and we came up with a bunch of words like rot gut and blind pig and shebas and all these fun words that people don't really use anymore. So that was kind of the fun in that song. And you need to talk a minute because I need to get something for this. So talk amongst yourselves.
So I'm sure you folks have been hearing this little guy down here. And that is my trusty thank you. Appreciate that nice guitar. You've been hearing this drum that I've been playing last song. And this is actually a home-built drum out of Carolina, North Carolina, Raleigh, I believe. And I've had this for about a year now. It's a fun little toy that we get to use for our show. So we hope you like that. We're gonna do another tune next. It's one of ours. It was kind of an idea that Steph, who just came back, an idea that Steph had for quite a bit, for a few years, and we kind of took the chorus and helped finish it up and turn it into a whole song. So this next tune is called You Ain't Nothing But a Fool.
But a Fool.
But a Fool. We hope.
Did you say hi to everyone saying hi?
I did. Hello.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. We appreciate it.
Here we go.
You ain't nothing.
not a fool. We're going to do another tune that I believe we did back at the Music Hall Lounge back in March. And this was kind of another idea of Steph's. And it was, we try to write a lot of story songs. Sometimes we kind of write to be a little more commercial in the sense of like how it's arranged and such. This one is kind of a total storyteller song. So
I read this book about these two people. And I left thinking, wow, was the myth the real truth, or is the legend merely a legend? So I kind of pondered a lot of questions about these two people in history, and I don't know. We'll never know, I guess. But we do want to tell the tale. Gutter of the West Texas slums. Two hearts blazed and couldn't be caged, so they lived life on the run. Times was hard everywhere, not much left to choose. We'd steal a car and drive it far and fast like lovers do. Was it just a joyride to have a little fun till things got out of hand? And nothing could be done. Was it cruel intention? Was it suicide? A true romance turned deadly dance for two kids named.
Who is it?
Bonnie and Clyde. Small Clyde never had a chance. Bonnie fancied Hollywood, damned her circumstance. They crossed state lines 100 times, a myth they were to some. Until the day the gamble made the murder with a gun. Were they cold-blooded killers, evil at a glance? Fresh and ever saints, fighting for a chance. Were they afraid for choices made? Was it freedom that they seeked? Was redemption out of reach? Could they not afford to ask the Lord to deliver what he preached? How can one survive? Their souls entwined forever. That's Bonnie and Clyde. stuff, which we will get back to because we like that. But this song's a little more, would you say, French influenced?
I don't know. Maybe.
Has a little bit of a Frenchy feel to
we'll
it.
We'll see. Oh, if we lose a bunch of viewers, they might not like it. They want
we'll
more
go,
Prohibition.
We'll go back to Prohibition. We'll see. Tom Waits. He talk about creating characters and telling a story, that man, I think, is probably the best at it. He creates these amazing people, and I don't know if he really knows them. If he does, he's has a lot of really cool friends. If not, he just has a great imagination.
Yeah, and, he's very imaginative.
This song is one that I...
He definitely didn't grow up with a smartphone.
No, he did not. No. He grew up with really imaginary friends.
Yeah.
So, anyway, this song was one that I've always loved, and it's got about 9 verses to it, which we have scaled back. Don't be afraid. I don't know, so we just kind of put our own little twist on it, and if you're a Tom Waits fan and you know this song, let us know what you think, because it's brand new for us.
And if you don't, check it out, because it's really cool.
If you don't know the song, definitely.
It's called Gun Street Girl. I always forget the beginning.
Completely messed up. I said, John, John, he's long gone. Gone to Indiana, ain't never coming home.
Coming home.
again for being with us tonight. I hope you all liked what you've heard. We are a tale of two. We will have an album out sometime in the coming year. And
yeah.
Thanks to our guests in the house tonight.
Don't worry, it's only friends and family. We're
friends.
Social distancing.
Yeah.
Well, we're not having
whatever.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah. So this last song, I wanted to leave everybody on a happy note. This was one of my favorite songs as a kid. And, we kind of took it and kind of put our own little spin on it. And so I just want to leave you with some happiness. So thanks for being with us, y'all. We will see you somewhere down the road. Thanks so much. Again, my name is Stephanie Adlington, Aaron Lessard, and we are a tale of two.
All right, here we go.
From their home in Franklin, Tennessee, supported by an audience of family and friends while they played a virtual show on the Mountain Spirit Acoustic Series Facebook page, that was A Tale of Two. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.